The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, everyone. For purposes of the webcast, we're about to start our third panel right now. Welcome now to the third of our four panels here today. We've had a nice segue from the preceding speaker with respect to pending legislation, and that's exactly what this panel is designed to focus on. Bills that are pending both in the House, as Congressman Nadler spoke of this morning, and also in the Senate. And once again, we're very lucky with the faculty that we have here at the Washington College of Law. We had for the first panel Professor Frost, who had written an article on the state secrets privilege, to moderate that first panel regarding the privilege's background. And on a second panel, we had Professor Marcus, who worked at a very high level within the Department of Justice and was able to very well handle the Department of Justice's policy panel. And for this third panel, just as well, we're very fortunate that we have here at the law school William Yeomans. Bill, immediately before coming here to the law school this year, worked on Capitol Hill as chief counsel to then Senator Ted Kennedy on the House Judiciary Committee, and he knows the legislative process very, very well, and there's no one who's, I think, better situated to moderate this panel. Bill will introduce the panel members, so I'll just turn it over to you with my thanks.
Okay, thank you, Dan. We have plowed some ground already on legislation, but we're going to try to find some new ground to dig up. And I'm delighted to be able to moderate this panel. And we have some terrific panelists today. And I'll go ahead and introduce them so you won't wonder who they are while they're sitting there. To my immediate right is Danielle Bryan, who's been the executive director of POGO, which many of you are familiar with, the Project on Government Oversight, since 1993. She has been involved in any number of extremely important and interesting and sometimes mysterious sounding projects to uncover information and to hold government accountable, going all the way back to Area 51? Yes. Okay, we're going to get into that. And then to her right is Sean Moulton. Sean is the Director of Information Policy at OMB Watch, where he focuses on government transparency, which is the topic of the day. And he has paid special attention to environmental information and some right-to-know issues. And then to his right is Heather Sawyer. And Heather, you saw her boss this morning, and is the majority counsel for the House Committee on the Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. So she works for Congressman Nadler. And she has been involved in the development of many of the significant pieces of legislation that have come through the House Judiciary Committee, but most relevantly for our purposes, the State Secrets Protection Act. So before we get to our panel, let me just see if I can provide a little bit of context, given all that we've already heard about the legislation. I think what we've heard is that without administration support, it's dead, that the House bill is much better than the Senate bill, these things may not be true. So we're going to explore whether they are or not. But let me give you a little bit of background about how we got where we are on the legislation. The Senate's involvement began really in 2007, this round. There have been previous considerations. But around 2007, as you'll recall, the fall of 2006 was very good for Democrats. And so in January 2007, the Democrats took over Congress. There was considerable optimism. For many years before that, of course, there had been growing frustration at the inability of Congress and, of course, of the courts to uncover a lot of what people suspected was going on in the Bush administration. And certainly there had been a failure of mechanisms to hold people accountable. So expectations were high that a democratically led Congress could make some progress, at least through the exercise of its oversight function. And while there was some progress, the administration successfully fended off, some would say stonewalled, most efforts. But the sense of frustration grew as the administration successfully asserted the state secrets privilege in a series of cases, some of which you've heard about. And it truly came to a head when the administration pushed hard for amendments to the FISA bill and included in that provision that would grant retroactive immunity to the telecommunications companies who had participated in the warrantless wiretapping. So through this period, frustration was growing, and Senator Kennedy decided that it was time to make a run at the state secrets privilege. And we worked with a number of other offices. I see that Liza has stepped out of the room. She was instrumental when she was working for Senator Feingold. We worked with a number of groups, including the Constitution Project, the ACLU, and others, and put together a draft bill. And we almost stuck it onto the FISA amendments, which may have been the last train leaving the station that could have gotten it to the next station. But we were dissuaded and convinced that we hadn't done our political work yet and that we wouldn't have sufficient support to keep it on the bill. So we didn't. But finally, Senator Kennedy introduced the Senate bill with Senators Leahy and Spector as original co-sponsors, and we moved it through the Senate Judiciary Committee in the spring of 2008. And we did have, we had a couple of amendments in the markup, and one I will just stop and talk about because it's gotten so much criticism today. And that is the addition of the substantial weight language. The original bill, and the bill as first offered in the committee, the bill that we produced, didn't say anything about a standard. And that was a conscious omission. But that void attracted the attention of Republican senators, particularly Senator Kyle, who was going to offer an amendment requiring that courts give utmost deference to administration officials. And we were in serious danger of losing at least Senator Feinstein in committee from the Democratic side. And so Senator Feinstein was convinced to offer an amendment to offer the substantial weight standard. The Democrats fell in line as a compromise to fend off something much worse. So, Lou, that's why that crazy language is in the bill. You can blame it on Senator Kyle. As you heard from Congressman Nadler this morning, there was a parallel process, of course, going on in the House. And I think the House first marked up its bill in September of 2008, and then again just last week. Let me just say that the Senate and House bills rest on several common principles, and we haven't really discussed them in a lot of detail, and in a minute I'm going to ask Heather if she'll fill in some of the blanks for us. But here are some of the common principles. First, the bills acknowledge that there is and should be a state secrets privilege, and they seek to set up a regime for considering assertions of the privilege that will ensure protection of secrets while affording justice to deserving plaintiffs. Second, they operate on the principle that the privilege is just that, an evidentiary principle, privilege rather, that applies to items of evidence and not whole lawsuits. Third, they rest on the view that courts must have the authority and the tools to review meaningfully the government's assertion of the privilege. That means that courts have to be able to examine the evidence that's alleged to be secret. And finally, the bills both recognize that to the extent possible assertions of the state secrets privilege should be subject, that possible assertions of the state secret privilege should be subjected to an adversarial process. Now, obviously, there are some differences between the Senate and House bills. We've discussed some. Some others may come out during the conversation. I hope that we will also discuss the prospects for enactment and discuss possible paths to enactment. And we will also discuss, I think, a little bit the rationale for continuing to press for legislation, even if the prospects are not glowing at the moment. So let me first, I guess, turn to Sean, who I think, let me ask you, Sean, if you can lay out some of the rationale for going ahead with legislation at this point.
Sure. And I think it's a before we get into the paths forward and the difficulties we face, I think it's important to acknowledge the importance of going forward with a legislative path. OMB Watch was very supportive and very happy with the Obama administration's new policy, that the new administration had come in at least to acknowledge that a policy on state secrets had to be vocalized and laid out. To some extent, they promised more than they delivered, and we certainly feel some disappointment in that. But we felt it was certainly a good step and a good sign from an administration to voluntarily start to put together some limitations on the state secrets. That being said, I think there is no doubt that even if the Obama administration delivered on all of its promises, a legislative solution is an absolute necessity to a long-term solution for the state secrets privilege. And that is Congress's role. I mean, we've seen it before historically when you've had other problems, other abuses, the Freedom of Information Act, whistleblower protections. When the executive is misusing its authority to withhold information, to shut down whistleblowers, then it's been up to Congress, as sometimes difficult as it's been. I mean, when the original FOIA was put together, and it was not even that strong of a FOIA originally. I mean, it was later that really teeth got added to it. It was not a very popular thing with the administration, and Congress had to go forward with it regardless of that. Earlier, it was talked about that maybe courts could have started to define this better and played a more active role, more robust role in interacting with the executive. And I guess that's possible, but I don't really see that as the court's strength. For setting up procedures and policies on what is allowed, what is not allowed, and how it'll be oversight and reporting, that's really where Congress and the executive interaction is the best tool forward. As I said, even if the Obama administration delivers on its promises and we get some acknowledgement of policy, executive order possibly even, on congressional on judicial oversight, what they promised to deliver to the court every time they claim state secrets and what can be reviewed, how they will do it in camera review. Even if it was everything I wanted, I would still then want that to be put into a legislative bill, put through Congress, and signed into law. And I really feel that obviously there's a real political challenge here. Whenever you're talking about anything to do with national security and homeland security, terrorism, there's a new political charge to it. And it makes it a more difficult message, a more difficult thing to talk about. But with an administration in the White House now that is at least acknowledging there's a problem that has to be addressed, I think even if they're not backing the current efforts and possibly, and I don't know this, but possibly even trying to derail those processes, I think you have a unique opportunity here that you might actually get an administration to sign that bill when it gets to their desk if it's a standalone bill. Obviously, I think the previous administration, we didn't even have that opportunity, and so maybe the next administration will be even more welcoming. But we have a moment in time here where if we can get it through Congress, which we will talk about the challenges of that, I think you have an administration that could be brought to the table and put their signature to it and hopefully make a permanent step forward on state secrets and not one that can be rolled back on the next administration.
Thank you. Sean, Heather, can you fill us in a little bit on the picture in the House and tell us, we keep talking about it. Can you tell us what it looks like?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I wanted to just start by saying I'm really thrilled to be here today. This is such a critical issue. You heard Congressman Nadler express his opinion, certainly, that this is one of the most critical threats to liberties at this point in time. And, you know, obviously he has worked very hard to raise the visibility of this issue and to do everything he can to move it on a positive forward pace in the Congress. And I just want to make clear that I'm thrilled to be here, and a lot of the people who have already spoken have been incredibly instrumental in educating the Congress and the committee and helping shape and frame the proposals for reform. And as I appear here today, as some of the other folks have made clear, you know, the views that I'm expressing are really my personal views. They are not the views of Chairman Conyers of the full committee. They're not Chairman Nadler's views. They're not the views of the Judiciary Committee. They're not the views of the Congress. Hopefully, however, they will be educational in terms of I obviously know quite a bit about what is in the bill and what the process that we've gone through thus far and the path that lies ahead. So, before I launch into what I hope will be a relatively short, you know, this fortunately is not a thousand-some-page long bill. It's a relatively short bill, both the Senate bill and the House bill. So I will try to get through that, but I think it would be good for us to kind of get a sense of what the actual legislation looks like in a hopefully thumbnail way. But as I listened this morning and through the day, you know, one of the things that always strikes me about this conversation about privilege is the way in which we usually conceive of privileges is that what they do is they remove certain information, if you want to call it information, evidence, facts, maybe, or at least a route to proving facts from a case. So, for example, the privilege against self-incrimination, which undoubtedly is rooted in the Constitution as a constitutional right, would potentially remove from a case one way, one route of proving facts. It wouldn't necessarily mean that the case could not go forward. It would foreclose a route, one route, out of the defendant's own mouth of proving that. Attorney-client, same thing. It knocks certain routes of proving information out of the case. None of these privileges operates in a way to say that you could not otherwise litigate the underlying subject matter. And so I do think that a lot of times when we're in this discussion, it's important to remind ourselves that the state secret privilege is argued in a way that is very unique, even though it is considered and called a privilege. And the other thing that is overlooked a bit is the notion that when the courts currently, if they find the privilege to be validly asserted, they don't simply apply the rule that they would usually apply, which is that the evidence simply drops out of the case. There is a very clear exception to that rule, and that is the evidence, if it were deemed to interfere with what is construed as a valid defense, then you can dismiss. Because if you just drop the evidence out of the case, the person who was deprived of their valid defense would have judgment entered against them. So in that context, there is, at some level, a decision on the merits being made in secret and to the possible detriment of a party who may not have seen it. Now, this is a notion that makes us, most of us, if not all of us, profoundly uncomfortable, but it is one we should grapple with honestly and acknowledge when we're figuring out how we want to resolve this issue of privilege in a way that at least acknowledges that, if not altogether accounts for that. And so that is one of the ways in which the bills differ slightly and I think are still obviously open to a lot of discussion and debate and, you know, quite frankly, as with legislation often, as the vehicles move through their respective chambers, there's the opportunity for them to be improved all along. And they will ultimately, on some of the issues, have to be reconciled. But the bills share in common much more than what they differ. Structurally, they look very different, but they end up doing a lot of things very similarly. So I will run through pretty quickly how the House approach goes. And like I said, I'll point out the really couple of ways in which there is a substantive, not just structural, departure. In the House bill, you know, it starts by just simply setting out and articulating the privilege. It says that the government has the right to withhold information or keep another party from publicly disclosing information where that information is reasonably likely to cause significant harm to the national defense or diplomatic relations, i.e. national security. Now, this is essentially the standard, same standard in both bills, significant harm, reasonable likelihood. It is the standard that the administration in its policy just issued a few months ago has embraced. I do agree, and I think it is a forward step that this administration has articulated that as the standard that they believe, even if we do not think it's enough to simply have executive branch oversight, they have taken a positive step forward in articulating a standard that has been unclear as in the courts and has certainly been argued as something different by other administrations. So that's the basic standard. It articulates that the government's, it's the government's privilege, but that they can intervene to do so, to assert it. The bill then has a section that, in you know my estimation, doesn't necessarily break new ground in the sense that a lot of the tools that are set forth as expressed in both bills are tools that already exist for the courts, but it does explicitly talk about the courts having an obligation to take the steps that are necessary to protect sensitive information. So this is even during resolution of the claim. Obviously, it gets at you know what Lou Fisher was talking about in terms of, you know, a lot of times in these conversations, there's a very loosey-goosey discussion about what disclosure means. Is it public disclosure? Is it disclosure to the court? Is it the disclosure to the court and potentially other non-governmental parties under procedures that still require that that information be kept in a way that is not public? Is it in camera? Is it ex parte, et cetera? So both bills talk about the need for the courts to grapple with and use tools that they often use and certainly are available to them to protect sensitive information. You know, they do so in a way. In our bill, we explicitly say that even in the resolution of the privilege claim, to the extent that the court feels that asking the government to produce a substitute for the information that is going to seek to withhold so that that would allow a more adversarial and robust process, that the court should do so. So it talks about a substitute even pending resolution of the privilege claim. You know, the next section just simply, again, articulates the government can raise the state secret privilege in relation to a claim or a counterclaim. It's a bit the point that Bobby Chesney pointed out a little earlier. It makes clear that the government, where the admission or the denial of information alleged might disclose information that they are then going to claim the privilege over, they have the right to assert the state secret privilege at that point. That is not meaning that they can then foreclose the discussion about whether or not what it is they want to withhold or what they would have to admit or deny actually is subject to the privilege, but it is to kind of take off the table the notion that they would have to upfront admit or deny facts that they feel would reveal information. Our bill specifically then says to the court, we want you to hold preliminary proceedings before you get to the actual hearing. This is an attempt to really make sure that the court is being absolutely thoughtful and consider all the avenues that are available to resolve any issues and disagreements that might be arising about what extent, if any, counsel can be involved in these proceedings, whether or not there is non-privileged discovery that should be proceeding in tandem with a discussion on the privileged information, and to also require the court to consider whether the appointment of an independent expert or a special master would assist. Obviously, these are tools that a court can reach out for now. They exist in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. They aren't things that we've invented along with the bill. We have just asked that courts consider the use of these. And again, part of this is to grant both a comfort level for the courts that they are fully authorized and equipped to make decisions and to, you know, use the tools at hand to make sure that they are comfortable. And it is also, you know, to make, again, part of this is, you know, part of the goal is to make sure that there is robust and meaningful review and to restore not only the illusion but the reality of kind of confidence in the system. So it does ask for these preliminary proceedings. Then, you know, the kind of, you know, one of the kind of key substantive provisions is the next section, Section 6, which talks about the actual standards. It does require that the court hold a hearing and examine. And the way I would put it, instead of getting into the discussion of is it evidence, is it information, the court has to look at what it is the government is seeking to withhold and why. And it really has to match those two questions and see if they meet the standard. It does allow for sampling because some, you know, one of the, I think, legitimate concerns is if the volume of what they are seeking to withhold is so grand that a court could not possibly review every single what, much less match it to the why, then it does allow for sampling. It does say so long as the sampling would allow you to make the independent assessment that this section requires you to make. Again, there's been a lot of discussion of the level of deference. I think there are arguments on both sides as to really what needs to be done, what the Constitution demands, what the Constitution will tolerate. We had lots of wonderful expert testimony on that issue, and I think, both bills handle it slightly differently. And again, that's an issue that will be looked at going forward, will have to be reconciled, obviously, to the extent we get to a point when we can reconcile them and get them to a president's desk for signature. The section makes clear that the burden of proof on these issues remains on the government. And then after that, the next section really says, so what happens? We've gone through this great process. You've got all these procedures. When the rubber hits the road, what happens? And it basically says, if the court determines that the evidence is or information is not privileged, it can issue appropriate orders requiring disclosure or use at trial. The issuance of those orders or the making of that decision then triggers a right to interlocutory appeal. And I want to spend a moment on that because this has been an issue of great concern to every administration and certainly with this administration. And it is an issue in the bill that I feel there's not enough emphasis with regard to why it would be in the best interest of an administration to come to the table on this, because there have been cases where a district court has, in Al-Haramain, and right now I'm not remembering, in Horn versus Huddle, where the district court basically said, look, I am not agreeing with you on the issue of that you can withhold this specific document. I want you to enter into a protective order. I want us to get a process here, and I want you to turn it over. And the government has sought immediate interlocutory appeal, which has been denied them. And so they have resorted to some other creative arguments, using classification authority to say that they do not need to turn over the document, because they feel that they should not be forced to make their ultimate decision as to whether they're going to comply or not until they've had the right to have appellate review of the decision. Our bill, as does the Senate bill, grants that right to interlocutory appeal, which is not something they have in current law. So, one of the reasons that we'll probably get into as to why an administration might be willing to otherwise come to the table when doing so might appear to be not in their best interest, one of the reasons would be if there are actually positive things that the law could give them that they don't currently have. And this is certainly one of them. And I would have to say that I do not think it's a small one. I don't think the idea that they could have federal court review of this decision immediately before they would be required to move forward is a small benefit for them. It has reporting requirements that have been discussed a little bit, again, to make sure that Congress knows when the privilege is being asserted and has some opportunity, kind of puts Congress on notice that if you're going to do something about this, then you need to do something, because in some instances, Congress is not aware. It does require, let me just say, I skipped over one other very significant aspect. If the privilege is then valid, it does say you cannot force public disclosure of that information. And you must consider whether or not there's a substitute. And if there is a way that a substitute, a summary, a redacted version could be used, then you should move forward on that ground. And if you cannot do that, then what our bill says is that, and it resorts to the language in SEPA, that the court can issue appropriate orders in the interest of justice. That might mean, in a given case, that they would dismiss the case, because, indeed, there was a valid defense that was being prevented from being brought forward because of the assertion of the privilege. It does certainly not foreclose the idea that, and we heard this morning in the discussion of at least some of the cases, one of the alleged stumbling blocks for some of these plaintiffs is the issue of standing. It doesn't foreclose the notion that if, indeed, a state secret privilege document was establishing standing, that the court might say you have to assume that fact against yourself so long as we can do so and not disgorge information that would harm national security. So it leaves up to the court some creative avenues. And that is different than what the Senate bill does, which says you cannot dismiss, even if the privilege is validly, unless you see that the information that is subject to the privilege would have prevented the assertion of a valid defense. So it leaves open the opportunity for dismissal, and that is the kind of avenue that can be explored there. Now, in terms of ARBA, one other section that has gotten some comment is our section at the end in terms of its kind of effective date. You know, what we had tried to do, and there was a suggestion this morning, I think, about something tolling statute of limitations, because there is some, you know, concern that the operation of the privilege has not been handled well and that we should give the opportunity for courts under these new standards to consider whether it would be appropriate to grant what is, you know, in a sense, what is modeled in the House bill is kind of on relief from judgment of Rule 60, which allows, in the discretion of the court, it's not mandatory, the court to consider whether or not they should reopen a case, and it has certain timelines. You have to file within a year of the passage of the law, just simply so it's not something sitting out there. But it is one creative way to try to at least allow for the consideration or an option for some of the parties who feel that they have been unfairly and unjustly denied an opportunity to be in court, an opportunity to make the case that their case should be revisited under this new standard. Thank you. I think that's...
Yeah, that was great. Let me turn to Danielle. And so now we know what it is. The question is how it can become law. And I think it's safe to say that we're in a difficult environment. If the administration maintains its silence, doesn't come out in strong support of the bill, which it doesn't appear that it will anytime soon, then we fall back on sort of the normal political currents. And one of the ways that this area tends to get discussed is in terms of who's for the terrorists and who's against them. And unfortunately, I think that supporters of this bill will be portrayed by opponents as being soft on terrorism. So there's a hurdle there to overcome, and it seems to require a lot of political work at various levels to get it done. Is it possible?
Wow. I get to answer that question. First of all, I think you're right. We heard Don say something like, we certainly wouldn't endorse the current language or something, right? I mean, it was pretty clear that was the case. And I think part of why I was asked to be on this panel is because of my hat as a passionate advocate for Congress and congressional oversight and the role of Congress as an equal branch of government. And as much as I don't want to let the executive branch off the hook on the importance of their coming out in favor of this, I think there's a little too much discussion of letting the Congress off the hook in not saying, you know, we should be moving forward whether the administration is behind us or not. I think as a Smith College grad, I have my feminist credentials. I can say it's time for Congress to sort of man up on this and recognize that I think there's... I would hate if we, a year from now, still have a stalemate because everyone's sort of looking at each other waiting for somebody to do something. And I fear that that's what we're going to be stuck with. And one of the things that I wanted to ask Don, actually, was do they believe that what they've done so far will protect us when we have President Palin or President Jeb Bush? Sorry. It's crazy to just echo what Sean said. You can't possibly, with something as utterly as important as this, you cannot possibly just rely on executive branch administrative order to protect us from the overreaching executive branch. So one of the things that it struck me, so it's easy for me to say that, you know, Congress has got to do something. And, you know, Heather has been talking, and as you had raised also, how this can be painted as a pro-terrorist bill. And I also think it's bizarre to me that it is generally sort of lockstep Republican opposition, because to me, this is classic conservative philosophy that you don't trust a strong government and you want to curtail its power to invade our lives. So I don't understand that position, but that being what it is, one of the things that we've talked about was I believe that at this point this is the role of our universe, the academics, the NGOs, the grassroots groups, to make it impossible for the Congress or the executive branch not to do the right thing. We need to make it painful for them, which is giving cover to the good guys, because right now it's clear that they feel kind of out there, and we don't have the luxury of sitting back and just being critical when they don't do their job. So how do we do that? I'm not good at marketing, but that's really what we need to think about as a community, is how do we twist the concept of this as actually being pro-terrorist, and I would love to hear suggestions on that. From our experience, in our investigations, we've come up against the state secrets privilege 4 times, none of which involve terrorism at all. And I think part of what is very helpful is to start recognizing how it has been used over time. I mean, when you mentioned Area 51, that's a fun case. Okay, in that case, we had a widow who came to us because her husband had been working at this super secret facility. Now, this is before there were video games that talked about Area 51. This was actually, I know exactly when it was, because I was having my daughter, so it was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, a widow says, my husband's been working at this facility. He would actually have to get on a plane from Las Vegas and fly to the secret place and work during the day and come home to her. He was having such terrible health problems, literally, ultimately, his skin was falling off. And so this was an environmental crimes case. This was a case of they were burning in open-air pits toxins, and we were just trying to find out what they were. And the government's position was that it wouldn't, they referred to it as the facility about which we will neither confirm nor deny. And that was as far as we could get. So, you know, we could go nowhere. It was a state secret privilege to acknowledge that the place existed, which is crazy because, really, within a year, there were video games about this place and, you know, the Martians that are supposed to be kept there. And so I think possibly what we could do is recognize that this is really just, and ultimately it was really an environmental crimes case. This was a case where, because Lockheed Martin, because of state environmental law, could not dispose of certain toxins at their facilities at the Skunk Works in California, they were trucking them overnight and burning them in Nevada, where state law didn't prohibit it. And that's what this case was about. And that was an example, and it's not that long ago. We're not going back to Reynolds there, where the government was just hiding environmental crimes and using state secrets to do that. So I think one of the things I would suggest we should be doing is taking those cases, or the case where Sibel Edmonds, who was the FBI contract translator, who was disclosing incompetence by the FBI, and they used state secrets privilege to deny her ability to say what languages she spoke and where she was born. And I think if we paint the absurdity of the use of state secret privilege, and that it really is being used in modern times in order to hide government's misconduct, not just decades ago, but even recently, that will be the kind of thing I think that could be helping give cover and should theoretically appeal, if not to conservative politicians, the conservative people out at the town hall meetings that are sort of scared of our government.
Sean, did you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with Danielle that Congress does face a difficult dilemma here in terms of they know the political reality is if they come forward strongly on this that they run the risk of being painted with a relatively broad brush that somehow they are almost unpatriotic. Even though what they would be trying to do is a very fundamental checks and balances, constitutional mechanism kind of patriotism. And so, to some extent, the more the public demands it, and it's hard to get the public to demand something like this. You have some very clear cases, I think, where it's either absurd or some cases where you can show some pretty severe damages that are done to individuals by, you know, by the government, by the man, which I'm agreeing with Danielle completely that I'm surprised that there aren't more libertarian groups sort of rising up against this, saying, you know, we're worried about not how it's being applied right now in these terrorism cases, but we're worried how it's going to be applied down the road.
Yeah, well, a couple. I mean, it's always helpful to have very sympathetic victims, you know, people who have really been screwed over by this problem, and that's one way to get Congress going. I think that's hard to do here. You know, we find the victims sympathetic. Their rights have been denied. They've been horribly treated. But in the eyes of the general population, I think they're often suspect. So the other way it seems to me to move this is on sort of big themes, like, you know, separation of powers. We don't want to have an unchecked executive. You know, all the important things that we talk about and care about. But those are notoriously weak drivers of political action. Unfortunately, they should be much more significant. So I think it's a real dilemma, and I think one thing that brings home to us is that maybe we need to continue to focus more and more on getting the administration to come around. And in that regard, Heather, I'm wondering if you've been having any conversations with the administration that suggests one way or the other that there is progress or not.
Certainly we are engaged in what I think are very productive and, you know, from our perspective, appreciated, and I think they equally appreciate discussions. And, you know, I certainly don't want to delve into the substance of those discussions, but I think it is important to recognize that even just in the public domain that of what we have seen in terms of where this administration positions itself on this issue, I think it, you know, one thing that I think echoes something Danielle said, which is, you know, in some ways this forum proves that for at least what I assume in terms of the folks who put some of our colleagues who are in the administration a little bit on the hot seat today, what proves at least from a progressive agenda is that this isn't a partisan issue, because we have a democratic administration that, you know, folks are trying to hold to account on an issue that they feel is important for some of the broader institutional issues. So some of the work obviously is still trying to get the public at large to understand the importance of this issue that goes beyond partisan politics. But in terms of areas of progress that, you know, I understand the devil is in the details, but I don't think that we should fail to appreciate the fact that, very much unlike the prior administration, this administration has not taken the hardline position that it is beyond the authority of Congress to legislate in this area, which, you know, Attorney General Mukasey wrote a letter to the Senate taking that very position. Now, I know for a lot of people that's small solace because they feel like that's a red herring argument and that it's not one that should carry the day. But it is easy cover for anyone who wants to oppose state secrets legislation. It's easy cover that isn't on the table for those folks right now. They have to make that argument for themselves, and they don't have a Department of Justice who's going to back them on that argument. So that, I mean, I think we have to look at the ways in which this is still an uphill battle, and I think that people have to both be invested in kind of what some might say is kind of the broader, more aspirational view of why people go into politics, either at the congressional level or going into the executive branch, which is in part to, you know, wield their power in a way that creates and has legacy. So I do think that, you know, there is still a lot of room for the discussion, and the devil does come down to the details, and the devil comes down to figuring out a level that compromise could be reached in a way that still created meaningful change. And, you know, that's part of what's being hashed out. I think pressure is needed, both pressure and pressure which is partially educational. This has to be an issue that registers on people's radar as kind of, you know, it's not always an easy one to explain quickly. And the sound bites don't run in the favor of the folks who are seeking the reform. But part of it is raising the visibility. Part of it is helping the administration understand why it needs to be at the table and why it will be detrimental to it. You know, another thing is trying to obviously look for opportunities to pair it with legislation that needs to be moved, and to create both the understanding that this bill should be treated with the same respect and urgency as other priorities. You know, so, you know, that's really, I think we can't underestimate that there is greater room to put the pressure on both the Congress and the administration. But, you know, politics are, at the end of the day, people will make a determination as to whether or not, you know, it will really hurt them or help them to take certain action. You know, and that's kind of our collective job, is to make both the administration and the Congress writ large understand that it is in both the both in terms of politics and in terms of the principles at issue here, it is in their best interest to move this forward.
One of the things that also struck me that's important is, for there are many groups, for example, that are members of OpenTheGovernment.org, that, like POGO, where state secrets is a tremendously important thing, but maybe not something I'm thinking about every day or every week. But we need to realize that this is a unique opportunity this year, where we have the legislation that's moved in the House, we have an administration that's talking about it, and to elevate it on our agendas to something that we all need to collectively say, okay, we need to move this to the top, because we all need to make it a priority at this point.
Okay. I think given that we have a number of people here who have been involved either in the development of the legislation or its consideration or have thought about it otherwise, I think we might as well go ahead and open it up to questions. So let's follow the usual procedure, and if you have a question, please come to the microphone. Yeah.
So I'm Bobby Chastney from University of Texas, and I wanted to draw your attention to a feature of both bills that address the status quo of ex parte proceedings when it comes to the judge deciding whether or not, in fact, whatever's been put before the judge suffices to show that the standard for application of the privilege has been met. As I understand the legislation, or as I would describe it, there are really two tracks you can go if you want to introduce some level of adversariality. You can empower the judge, as FISA 1801F, I think, does, or maybe I got the site wrong, but you know what I'm talking about, allow the attorneys in the actual case representing the litigants to participate, or you could go the guardian ad litem slash special advocate route. I think some of y'all know that I'm a proponent of the latter, not the former. I'd like to hear your thoughts about this generally, but I'd specifically like to hear you address why it's not good enough to do the guardian ad litem procedure, and why you might need to go further to the other side. Thank you.
I'm passing on that one. I think that's for you, huh?
Sure.
Since you're now on board with the guardian ad litem.
Right. I mean, one thing that did come up during the markup in the full Judiciary Committee was an amendment offered by Representative Schiff, a Democratic member of the committee, to insert a provision, remove a provision in the House bill as it then stood, which would have had the court go through a procedure where they, in kind of a successive way, sought to have the existing party representing, counsel representing the party, seek and obtain clearance from the government when that was at all possible, leaving at all times it within the government's control as to whether it clears a particular individual. Mr. Schiff offered an amendment that would allow and authorize the court to appoint a guardian ad litem to represent a party from a list of attorneys who had already been cleared to represent the party's interests. Now, you know, it's important to note that, you know, that amendment, the original provision and that amendment, are both offered with the desire and trying to create a mechanism by which some of these proceedings could be more adversarial, against a backdrop where, as you know, Bobby, as you've recognized, where they simply are not in most of any of the cases that I have examined. They're not adversarial. So trying to inject some level of testing of a government's claim. That's also the spirit with which we've asked the court to consider an independent expert to potentially be appointed. The concern, now Mr. Nadler agreed with that amendment. He offered a secondary amendment to at least require the court to consult and with the party who was then going to be represented by this guardian ad litem, and hopefully select, with the agreement of that party, someone from this list of pre-cleared. You know, it has the advantage of certainly streamlining some of this proceeding, because the clearance process can take some time in and of itself. But the concern to the extent we're using guardian ad litems as opposed to attorneys who generally represent parties is guardian ad litems usually are appointed in circumstances when we deem, for whatever reason, a party not able and capable to make its own decisions. So, you know, there is a level of discomfort with saying you take all of the decision-making from the party and from that party's designated counsel and put it in the hands of a guardian. Now, at the same time, there are obviously some pretty successful, and I would point to what the Arar Commission up in Canada did. There are some relatively successful examples where they went through a very vigorous process of testing claims of secrecy by the Canadian government with the use of guardians ad litem, who were appointed for the purposes of making out the adversarial claim for the party who could not be present or that party's counsel. So it is something that I think, again, the Senate bill is slightly different. It does contemplate the appointment of the guardian. I think we will be looking for the best way to make sure that we are, again, encouraging an adversarial process, but not, I think that people value and understand that, you know, litigants should be able to participate as robustly as possible in their own case. And that sometimes the notion that the current counsel cannot or should not be cleared is one that shouldn't just always be a presumption. It doesn't necessarily always make sense that this party can't be cleared or shouldn't be cleared. It kind of smacks a little bit of the notion that anyone that would represent one of these people is inherently untrustworthy. I think from the party's perspective, there is a time issue that's always involved, but if they're willing to undertake that concern and put themselves through the process, then it shouldn't be automatically foreclosed. And I also think that, you know, just to state it, that one of the things that in speaking with people about it, both the folks who are responsible for enacting the legislation, you know, one of the things that is a little bit hard to take and came up a little bit, and I can't remember in what comments, both with regard to a reluctance to show sometimes the court and a reluctance to have cleared counsel and go through that process, is this notion that a lot of this information is seen by a lot of people within the executive branch. And the idea that under proceedings that are very protective and where it is a violation of criminal law, if you violate an order and disclose the classified information, that there are people that we wouldn't even contemplate clearing for reasons that seem presumptively, you know, at odds. I think everyone's struggling with just the correct balance to strike there. So that's a much longer answer than your question. But.
Well, I had one more quick question. Your retroactivity provision, your Rule 60 provision,
yes,
allows reopening judgments going back to January 1st, 2002.
Right.
How did you pick that date?
Well, yes.
I wondered that.
It's a very good question. And, you know, when I looked at the bill, I had to remind myself how we chose that. And the reason we chose that was because the statute of limitations for bringing a claim against the government in a civil context is usually a six-year time period. So at the time we were first contemplating the bill, that was roughly the six-year time period. And we wanted to kind of set something that looked reasonable, both in terms of when you would need to file, so that was kind of the 1 year within enactment, and kind of a set time that if you had not brought your claim within this period of time, the statute would have run. From my perspective, again, this is one way to try to get at some of the concerns that people have raised about, through a different mechanism, you know. So it's not, that is the rationale behind it. I think other rationales could support other timelines. And obviously, unless it's enacted soon, that will be without. I think it's already outside the.
Yeah.
Well, I was optimistic that would be enacted within the six-year time period.
Yeah.
Hi, Seema Ahmad from the Open Society Institute. Just a quick question on timing, that if this doesn't get done this year, what the scope and potential is for doing this at some point in the future. And related but slightly different, given that there has to be, it seems, quite a bit of education done on this issue with members of Congress and the public, sort of all of your thoughts on the sort of larger issue that we've talked about, aside from whether or not the privilege is validly asserted, how we preserve and recognize people's right to a remedy whose rights have been violated, as Congressman Nadler said, so that really the privilege is just the first part of the inquiry, but this larger issue, and that if we don't push state secrets legislation through this time, maybe there's the opportunity to shift how we think about it over a long term with emphasis on that latter part.
Well, in terms of this year, I think we couldn't possibly be thinking this year, meaning 2009, right?
I mean,
certainly in the Senate.
I think, you know, the short-term legislative prospect is not not real promising. And I think, as Heather suggested before, this is probably not going to move as standalone legislation. Mm-hmm. It's going to have to find a vehicle. And it's always hard to predict when that vehicle is going to come along, but the one thing you have to think about is to be ready for the vehicle. So what it requires is doing the grassroots and other political work now so that when it is time to go, you can go. But I think at this point it's very hard to see it happening soon or to predict when it might.
Senate bill's not even out of committee this time, right?
No.
Yeah.
So.
Of course, it can be stuck on to something at any time.
Yeah, I mean, just as a practical matter, obviously, you know, if it doesn't pass within this Congress, it has to be reintroduced. It has to be, you know, from the House perspective, marked up again. The Senate will have to do that regardless. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of just outright timing, if it doesn't make it within the next calendar year, which is the second session of this Congress, then it would have to kind of start the process over again. Mm-hmm. Obviously, part of the process is educating, so hopefully many of the members who had already been educated would still be in the Congress, mm-hmm. you know, the House. Everyone comes up for re-election. But you know, as a practical matter, that would then have to start the process over in terms of getting it. Now that it's been reported out of committee, it really can be ready for floor action at any point in time within this Congress. And so that is in part, you know, why we felt it was important to make sure that it is, in essence, ready to go whenever and however we can make that happen. In terms of your other question, which it gives me an opportunity at least to say just for the moment, you know, one of the things that has been discussed in the course of the day is, you know, this embracing of other alternatives to the avenue of the courts to vindicate rights or to provide public accountability. And I certainly, I think, you know, folks embrace having robust alternate avenues. You know, I just want to express that in terms of, you know, things obviously don't progress in a vacuum, as state secrets has been considered by the committee. You know, other issues have been considered. One of those issues is really the issue of rendition writ large, and certainly Meher Arar's case. And I just want to point out that for him, this is an individual who, in December of 2002, 2 months after he was released from Syria and returned to Canada, Chairman Conyers asked for an Inspector General investigation. It took us 6 years to get released to the committee the Inspector General report. So 6 years later, an Inspector General report. The Inspector General came before the committee and explained all of the difficulties the Inspector General had, because an Inspector General does not have the authority to compel anyone to cooperate with their investigation. They had difficulties getting people to talk to them. They had difficulties getting anyone to release information that had been classified by various agencies. You know, even the public version of that Inspector General report is very troubling, in that it does indicate that individuals who are making the decision believe that it was reasonably likely that he would be tortured if sent to Syria, and that the assurances that they obtained had never been tested. Now, in light of that, the question then kind of remains, why has there been no further action affirmatively on its own by this government, either the past administration or this one, to get to the bottom of this man's case, despite the fact that they have been asked time and again, both prior and this administration, to really investigate what happened here and to help this man clear his name in a way. He is still on our no-fly list. He sought another through another avenue, the courts. You know, his case was dismissed not ultimately on state secrets, another problem. He didn't have a claim. But in any event, we need to work on both making sure, to the extent there are problems in the Inspector General avenue, making that more robust. But the next question is, you also have to then make more robust the court avenue. And it doesn't make tremendous sense to me to say, well, let's give the Inspector General subpoena power and let them act as a mini court, and at the same time we will foreclose the courts to these individuals. You know, so I do think there are obviously things that the more we build the case for having to make more comprehensive reforms in several areas, you know, the better off we'll be, and that, you know, one does not proceed without the other. But
We have experience with one case where it was has been attempted. We have tried for several years now to have an alternative to, because of the state secrets privilege being invoked on the Rich Barlow case, we've been trying to get the Congress to consider a private relief bill. This is a guy who was an intelligence officer who worked first at the CIA. During that time, he was responsible for helping to discover that AQ Khan was actually helping Pakistan obtain nuclear capacity, and he then went on to work with the Secretary of Defense. While he was there, he saw that the Pentagon was lying to the Congress about the fact that they knew Pakistan had nuclear ambitions while Congress was considering selling F-16s to Pakistan. So he says internally, you know, I think we should tell Congress the truth. I think it's we're lying to them. And he gets fired. So this is just a case of, he's not even a whistleblower, really. He's just a guy who says, you know, we shouldn't lie to the Congress. And in his case that was just a wrongful discharge case, state secrets is invoked. And so we have now, and Lou, how many years ago did this happen? This was in the 80s?
89.
Yeah. Okay. And we've only been involved the last few years trying to get the Congress, because of the state secrets privilege, to try an avenue that already exists, an alternative avenue that Congress has to give an individual private relief. And it's just, Congress is very uncomfortable doing it. It has just been an absolutely uphill battle. So.
And I would just chime in that, you know, we're also coming up on the anniversary of the Patriot Act, and we're reauthorizing that. And we're seeing a lot of difficulty even stemming some of the rather invasive authorities of the Patriot Act, some of which have never even been used. And yet the Department of Justice comes forward and says they're absolutely essential. This lone wolf privilege, you know, the ability to investigate these lone wolves who have no connection to anything else. And they said, well, we've never done it. We still need it. Or the national security letters, where there's been a lot of abuse that has been documented, and yet they don't want any limitations placed on it. And Congress is still very reluctant to start to curtail that, which, again, I think demonstrates, gives an idea of the uphill battle we face of making the argument that that civil liberties and protecting individuals has to start coming in on at least equal footing, if not, you know, the more important thing to start protecting, which is what I think a lot of actually the Constitution really says, is that is supposed to be more paramount than the investigation. And right now, Congress is still extremely reluctant to even acknowledge that it has to be given equal footing. So it's a lot of education ahead of us.
Good afternoon. Jason Allen with the Collaboration on Government Secrecy. It's clear that the House has taken the congressional lead on this legislation. I was wondering if you could speak to what sort of action we can realistically hope to see from the Senate in the near future.
Well, one thing I did want to mention, my counterpart on the Senate was hoping to be here today, had a scheduling conflict. The Attorney General was scheduled to come and testify before her committee. So unfortunately, she couldn't join us, and she would really be the person who could answer kind of what the hope was in terms of, you know, if it's scheduled. I know that, as was stated this morning by Congressman Nadler, it's just been true that both houses have been very understandably busy, both with the issue of economic recovery and health care reform. So I know that that has really taken up a lot of time. And, you know, I think, quite frankly, given those looming issues, it makes it very difficult to find time in the schedule to, you know, even on other important issues to reach them. But I do think, you know, obviously this is an issue that Senator Leahy and some of the other senators have been very invested and interested in, and I'm sure that they are looking for opportunities, just as we are looking for the same opportunities to move it forward. I think, you know, obviously it's helpful to them that the House has, you know, continued to move forward. It gives them, you know, good argument to keep their bill kind of moving along on a parallel track. So I can't answer the specific timing, but I know that it remains, you know, very much a priority for the lead folks over there as well.
One clue we do have, though, is Senator Leahy, after the Holder memo came out, did say he wanted to sort of wait and see how that played out. So I worry a little bit about the fact that he said that. That does that mean he sees less urgency than the rest of us might see?
Well, you know, I think obviously he sees the same, you know, things that happen in terms of both the policy went out. I don't think any of the members believe that is not a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously want to embrace the positive. I think that everyone is watching to see how it impacts the actual court mm-hmm. filings. I think some of that is starting to be answered, and the concerns remain that, you know, it is an internal check by the executive branch. Even the best internal check on the executive branch still only answers one piece of the puzzle. The other piece is the courts. And, you know, no one could really deny the fact that different courts handle the privilege differently. So, you know, if the only thing you wanted was consistency, you'd still need to enact guidance, and hopefully it would be clear enough guidance, and that's what we're striving for, that we would actually achieve consistency, and consistency in a way that moves the issue forward in a positive way. So I think, you know, people still understand that another big piece of this puzzle is just purely the courts, and the courts, you know, trying to struggle with what I think is, if nothing else, inconsistent guidance from the higher court, you know, where it says on the one hand you can't abdicate to the caprice of the executive, and on the other hand, but we won't look at the actual accident report. Now, the courts have tried to reconcile those competing, at least potentially competing, directives.
Last question.
Dan Scholar with the National Academy of Public Administration. Probably for Heather Sawyer. This is a rather narrow question, so you should be able to answer it quickly, but the Inspector General option seems very interesting.
Yes,
to those.
Sure.
But you spoke with somebody who indicated all the problems that might engender. Has there been any thought, since the House version is the leading version, to undertake some kind of a study of how this might work? Because we are messing with an effective but a rather wide mechanism that would work in so many executive departments alike. We've got a staff of inspector generals who know how to do their business. So
right.
To strengthen the case, wouldn't it be time to have some kind of a consulting examination of what the problems are and how well this would work? One could get actually perhaps greatly enthusiastic about this mm-hmm. As a fair way to provide substantial piece of the reform package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I certainly think it's a suggestion worth looking at. I think the concern remains, obviously people are welcoming the acknowledgement in the internal policy that to the extent there are credible allegations of misconduct, that would be referred to the Inspector General. You know, not to sound flip, but one would hope certainly that would already have been the case. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to have that confirmed, but certainly that seems to me just a routine call for an inspector general to do the investigation. Now, I mean, one of the difficulties with the inspector general process, which is true also of congressional oversight at some level, you know, and the one thing that the courts provide is that none of those avenues are within the control of the individual who is coming forward and saying, I have been wronged. And, you know, even the most compelling case for any reason, and it could be just pure resource, time, politics, may not get the attention from the Congress that it deserves. It may not get the attention at the executive branch that it deserves. So it's a very, I mean, I do think it's certainly, again, things that need to work in a complementary fashion. But I do think that, you know, one of the things that is a tremendous avenue for, you know, enforcement of rights in our country has always been the private right of action that we have enjoyed. And, you know, I think the desire here is to make sure that we are continuing to make that as robust as possible. So certainly I think it's worth considering, but I think it
might be a large contribution to the credible allegations part of the bill, credible allegations of government wrongdoing, and one that would find wide acceptance.
Well, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Please join me in thanking our panelists.